The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good afternoon, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here with News Dissector Radio every week at this time, Fridays at 1, here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. This is a pre-recorded program, so you can't I can't take your calls, but I think you'll find it quite fascinating. We have some wonderful guests with us this morning, and we're going to be talking about the economy. We're going to be talking about political strategy as the midterm elections near, or shall we say, threaten to erode the power and majority of the Democrats in Congress. We're going to be talking about the foreclosure, or shall we say, fraud closure crisis as well, and update that. Now, we've had an interesting week. Some good news actually has crept out of the news world. The rescue of 33 miners in Chile coming to the surface, all of them seemingly healthy, seemingly vibrant. They've survived an incredible ordeal, and what was amazing was the whole world's interest in this story. And here were people from another country, poor people in a remote part of a South American country, and yet there was a tremendous empathy and concern about their situation. Very dramatic, of course, the kind of event that television lives for, but you know, there are still unasked and unanswered questions about mine safety, how this happened in the first place, who these people were owning this mine that the mine workers union here in America told me was a pirate mine, unregulated, with no real enforcement of safety rules and regulations. Unfortunately, a very typical of that industry. We had 29 miners die in the United States, but last April, after that, there was supposed to be mine safety legislation, you know, quickly passed by Congress. It hasn't happened, largely because the Republicans are resisting this measure. So these issues are not just Chilean issues. They're global issues. We've had mine disasters in South Africa, in China, and here in the United States and in other countries. It's an industry that's really not being scrutinized enough, and clearly the product, certainly coal, is a questionable answer to our energy security needs. In this case, we were talking about gold, and of course the hunger for gold is driving a part of the economy today, and those miners were caught up in it, in the mania, and fortunately they're still alive thanks to an international effort which included Americans and people from many countries trying to help those people come out. The president of Chile, a right winger, not known for any particular interest in labor, maximized his visibility in the situation. Of course, as has been pointed out, there are other ghosts in Chile who have not been resurrected. The whole memory of Salvador Allende and the many people who died there after the coup that the United States supported during the Nixon administration, killing the dream of Chileans for a democratic society. So the Chile has been a country of tremendous opportunity, tremendous drive and energy, and at the same time of tremendous pain. And of course, the recent earthquake there didn't help things at all. It devastated parts of the country. So there's a context here that's often missing. That's what I try to do in my blog on mediachannel.org, is talk about not just the story, but what's behind the story. If you check it out today, you'll see some references to recent interviews I've done, and also comments on Chile, comments on the foreclosure crisis. So please do. It's at newsdissector.com/blog. That's what I write, you know, every day, and writing commentaries and trying to dissect news in ways that you don't see elsewhere. So please join me online as well as here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You're listening to News Dissector Radio.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never has it happened before. People have the same income, the same job, but are losing their home.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market, how can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
Well, that's from a collage produced by Polarity One and part of our efforts to try to bring these economic issues to the public in a popular way, to try to basically drive a deeper understanding of all of it. And joining me today, first is Sherry Welch, the dissectress, coming to us from Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Danny.
And Sherry has, she of the beautiful voice, is back again this week, and we're going to continue this discussion. We're really thrilled today to have as our guest in the first half hour of the program, Erica Payne. Erica is a public policy expert, a commentator, an author, and a strategist. She's the founder of the Agenda Project, whose goal is to build a powerful, intelligent, well-connected political movement capable of identifying and advancing rational, effective ideas in the public debate, and in so doing, ensure our country's success. She's the founder of the Tesseract Group, which is a consulting firm. She was one of the organizers of a conference called Make Markets Be Markets that the Roosevelt Institute sponsored with some of the top economists in the world, including George Soros, Elizabeth Warren, Simon Johnson, and others. She's the author of The Practical Progressive, How to Build a 21st Century Political Movement. I saw her in action last week at a debate about the Obama administration. Jonathan Alter of Newsweek took the position, you know, that basically Obama is a pragmatist. He can't do more than he can do, and that it's wrong to expect him to be able to instantly transform the country. He's a pragmatist, not a movement idealist. He was challenged by the author of a book about the more grassroots perspective, basically arguing that not only has Obama betrayed his most fervent supporters, but he's so far failed to advance key aspects of the agenda he promised. So, Erica, thanks for joining me. Why don't we start here with this midterm election that's coming up? It seems like the Democrats are in for shellacking, and it may not just be because the Republicans are so much smarter and stronger, but because the Democrats have not pursued a strategy to really reach out and build its own base. How do you see it?
Well, I'm actually in the process of working on a piece that is just one element of this that I'd love to bring to people's attention around the country who have been active financial supporters of Democrats, and that is that there have been some pieces out recently that Democratic members have not paid their dues to the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is allowed to spend an unlimited amount of money in races. And so when you see yesterday that Karl Rove and his group are doing a $50 million ad buy around the country to challenge these vulnerable Democrats, and then we have, you know, Democratic members who are sitting on about $100 million, they owe $24 million to the DCCC, and they haven't coughed it up. You know, I don't really see how they can expect us to, you know, beat the pavement for them and bring out the money for them if they're not willing to just open their campaign checkbooks if it's important enough, you know, if it's important enough to them to keep the house that they'll spend endless time trying to get us to raise money for them. It's certainly time that they open their checkbooks and try to keep this thing moving.
Well, we should, advise our listeners that Erica was the Deputy National Finance Director for the Democratic National Committee back in 1996 in the president's reelection campaign, and she's been a consultant to many campaigns. She's a, unabashed and non-defensive Democrat. At the same time, Erica, what I'm trying to get at is strategy, which is your specialty.
Right.
Are the Democrats pursuing a strategy? Is politics now all about money and none of that matters? Or does strategy matter? Does politics matter in a political race?
Well, the Agenda Project was founded on the overall idea that politicians are the least important part of politics. And so when I think about politics and advancing a public policy agenda, I think less about the politicians themselves than I do think about the playing field that they're operating on, because politicians at the end of the day will always be politicians. And I think that that's one of the points that Jonathan Alter made in his debate. I don't necessarily agree with everything that Jonathan said, but he did make the point basically that Barack Obama is a politician, and he believed that he was constrained by a set of factors of what he could get done. And so what I think that we progressives need to do over the long term is change the definition of what's possible. And then within changing the definition of what's possible, then push our elected officials to go as far into what's possible as we can. So when I look at the midterm elections, I really think that this is a piece of what is going to be a much longer struggle. And one of the reasons I think that Democrats are doing badly now, and why I think a lot of the policies that progressives were hoping would happen in the first 2 years of the Obama administration haven't happened, is that at the end of the day, we're still operating under the influence of a conservative movement that started being built in 1964 and basically still has control of the country, even though they've lost some of their Republican political power. You know, they haven't lost political power in terms of their agenda, still helps to define the parameters of the debate, for lack of a better way of saying it.
Well, I mean, just to continue this conversation with you, because I agree with you, politicians are not, the only factors in politics, and shouldn't be for that matter, and that the media focus on the horse race, who's up, who's down, what the latest polls are showing, reinforces the centrality of the politician, and often the importance of issues are kind of buried in that kind of a framework. But what troubles me is that it seems that there's a lot of unelected sources of power here that may have more influence on what certain politicians can do or can't do. I mean, Bob Woodward's book talks about how, the military basically just wouldn't go along with some of the things that he wanted to do and made it very difficult for him. In other words, there's power in a military-industrial complex. There's power in Wall Street basically framing and determining the limits of what politicians can do. I mean, I don't think they're totally free to do whatever they want.
I totally agree with you, Danny. And the analogy that I use when I talk to people about the work that has occupied about 99% of the last 10 years, it's to think of politics as having a value chain like any other business has a value chain. And so if you think of Nike has to source raw materials like canvas and rubber, design a tennis shoe, manufacture it, come up with marketing slogans like swoosh and just do it. And then they hire Michael Jordan to be their spokesman. And what progressives have done historically is searched endlessly for exactly the right Michael Jordan and spent no time at all designing a better tennis shoe. And so the work that I think needs to be, that is the most important work to be done to make long-term fundamental change, is to operate from the raw materials up through Michael Jordan. Now, obviously, we need to worry about Michael Jordan getting reelected in this midterm if we possibly can, but the only way to make real fundamental change is to go back to the raw materials. And the raw materials of public policy are academic theories around economics and law and that kind of thing. When you move up the value chain, you're looking at think tanks that take those raw materials and form them into specific policies, and then organizations that are able to package those effectively into, catchphrases like the death tax and the, some of those things that Republicans have come up with that have been so effective are actually because they have an infrastructure of think tanks, legal advocacy groups, media monitoring groups, all of this stuff that they've built since 1964 that now has a combined annual operating budget of about $300 million.
Well, first of all, I want to bring Sherry into this conversation because I know Sherry is very angry with some of what she sees as the stupidity, I don't want to put words in your mouth, of many Democratic politicians and self-defeating sort of strategies that they've pursued. You know, but to me, you know, we're talking about a situation where the Democrats, in a way, have as much money as the Republicans, maybe not quite as much, but a lot of money. The question is, are they spending it well? Sherry, comments, thoughts?
Well, I don't think that they're spending it well, and I have two questions for the lovely Erica. Is why isn't the DCCC supporting candidates like Justin Kasuli, who could actually give Congressman Boehner a run for his money? And then number two, I really like what you have with the Agenda Project, and I'm becoming a huge fan and getting all of my Facebook friends to join up on your Agenda Project.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Because you also said something that we must push our politicians how to do that. What do you have in mind as to how we can push them from the grassroots up? Because you're right, there is no infrastructure for us. And by the way, Danny, Democrats get more million-dollar contributions to the DNC and the DCCC than Republicans do. Is that correct, Erica?
Well, they can't get million-dollar contributions to the parties anymore because of the limits on campaign spending. But Democrats, put it this way, liberals probably have close to as much money as conservatives do. They're deploying it in very different ways towards very different sets of issues. So basically, if you look over the long term, we did an analysis. I helped start an organization called the Democracy Alliance, which is a network of millionaires and billionaires who were set up to fund some of this infrastructure on our side. And we did an analysis of the issues that attract the most money on both sides. And so progressive typically, I mean, and this is sort of everybody knows it, but when you look at the number, it's pretty astounding. Progressives have typically spent their money in issues like, you know, the environment, women's issues, things like that. Whereas conservatives have spent a tremendous amount of money on economics and law and the law and economics movement, which sort of combines the two disciplines. And these are areas that actually historically and currently progressives have not invested a lot of money in. So if you're looking to change a life, you know, change the fabric of the country, the intersection of law and economics, there's a whole lot of change inside the intersection of those two disciplines that progressives have largely ignored for the better part of 40 years. Now about the DCCC, just to hit that, I mean, here's the fact of the matter is there's $24 million of dues that Democratic members owe to the DCCC. And among the people who are the deadbeats, I mean, this is the part that drives me crazy. It includes two party leaders, two DCCC vice chairmen, all of the caucus chief deputy whips, two-thirds of the party's chairman, and all but three subcommittee chairmen.
Well, what does that tell you?
It tells me, I don't even know what it, I mean, it tells me that there are a whole bunch of donors out there who need to start making some phone calls to these party leaders and the vice chairman and say, you know, take out your checkbook. You're sitting on $24 million that you owe the DCCC that needs to be deployed today into these vulnerable races. And so when the DCCC pulls money out of races, they pulled money out of six races yesterday, canceled their ad buys, it's because the fact of the matter is when you have a limited amount of money and a very big and growing playing field of seats in play, you've got to focus your money where you think you can get the highest return on your dollar. And so they have to make that calculus every day looking at poll numbers and everything else. And I'm content to let them make those choices as the people who have the most data available to them. But if they had $24 million more than they currently have, they could certainly make more choices than they're currently making.
Well, you know, let's talk about this, because money is raised for what's called the air war. And in the period before an election, suddenly, you know, newscasts actually lengthen the amount of time they have there, because a lot of people want to buy ads in the news environment, thinking that these are the most thoughtful people watching the news, the people who've been watching the purple pill ads, you know, on the networks, okay? And they target, you know, the newscasts in many instances. And so there's this bombardment of so many ads that it's hard to remember one from the other, repetition, and I think they're very ineffective. But nevertheless, there are consultants making money on them. There are ad agencies making money by placing them and making them. And that is what politics is, as opposed to some sort of longer-term investment in creating independent, progressive media that could build an environment that would be supportive of progressive values. And what I see happening, and, you know, in my case is, you know, maybe a little atypical, in that I came out of CNN and ABC News and set up an independent company with the goal of trying to do programming for change in the world. And you know, what I found was that so-called progressive funders, all they wanted to fund was partisan politics. So we created a media channel to analyze the media, to show how the big problem in the media is not just Fox News, but all of them tend to use the same experts, narrow the issues,
yeah,
distort the issues. But there was no money for any of this. There was no investment in media. Meanwhile, the right, investing in talk radio, in creating institutions that would have an ongoing presence beyond an election. Fox News being an example, but not the only example.
And Dan, you're 100% right. I mean, you couldn't be more right. And just to pick up on two threads of that, so looking at the media environment in general, you know, I was involved with some of these efforts early on through my work at the Democracy Alliance, and I did some work with Air America Radio that made a play for this. And, you know, there are definitely some efforts that have been out there that have attempted to do this. And progressive donors, in my experience, are typically short-term. They look short-term. They don't really, I think a lot of them are still political donors rather than movement donors, and the political leaders have not helped the progressive funding community understand that they need to make a much more diverse set of investments over time in order to change the playing field, as I was talking about earlier, towards doing exactly what you're talking about.
Classic example, just on a political level. Here was Obama with this amazing election in 2008. I made a film about it, which I'd love you to see, called People's President, which is about the grassroots component of the election. Not about, you know, what Obama said to so-and-so, not about the events covered on the media, but the stuff the media didn't cover, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these people had a very, you know, David Plouffe, that they had a kind of grassroots strategy that was very effective, with a lot of training, phone chains, you know, a very effective mobilization arsenal of different, you know, weapons, if you will. And, you know, and once Obama got in office, they just basically paid lip service to it, didn't really keep it going as a real presence, figured, well, now we have the big job in the White House, in the big house, so we don't have to pay attention to any of this anymore. And I think the consequences of that are now quite visible.
So, well, Danny, I think that's true, and to pick up on that, there's actually, it's interesting to me to watch this whole thing unfold as somebody who since early 2003 has been working on building this infrastructure of organizations, think tanks, and grassroots groups and things like that that sits outside of politics that can have a stronger net effect on it. If you look at 2006 election, the midterm where Democrats took back the House, Rahm Emanuel, who, you know, is perfectly fine in many instances, I do think that he, as chairman of DCCC, he definitely went out and recruited some candidates who were more likely to win in some of these races, and he did the job that he was supposed to do. But the mistake, I think, that Rahm made and that the White House or the Obama campaign eventually made in 2008 was believing that they had had, you know, that they were the sole architect of their victory. And what really happened in 2006 is that the narrative around the culture of corruption was so strong that conservatives who were running for re-election were walking into a headwind. And that culture of corruption narrative that was so powerful was driven in large part by an organization called CRU, which is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. It's run by a woman who is a lovely human being and just an absolute pit bull on ethics in Washington, and she helped drive this whole narrative about how corrupt the Republicans had been, and that helped create a tidal wave for change that Rahm's candidates were able to ride on and come into the House. And what we saw when President Obama ran, there were some outside organizations that have been started, one in particular called America Votes, which is it's basically a kind of central hub for a lot of the different progressive infrastructure groups. And they split voter lists and make sure that if this voter is more likely to be an environmentalist, that the Sierra Club is talking to them. And, you know, so people are talking to trusted messengers who they interact with more than they interact with politicians. It's a fantastic tool. It's particularly a fantastic organization now that people's party affiliations are dropping as politicians and political parties in general are getting less popular. America Votes is a great tool. During the 2008 election, the Obama campaign told their funders, do not fund these groups. So
what?
Yes, actually told their funders, we do not want to see you fund America Votes or any groups similar. And so when they came into the White House, basically the same message was put out to all.
So there you go. I mean, a deliberate
funders. I mean, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, but this was a deliberate effort to demobilize, you know, a hyperactive, maybe because they knew they couldn't meet the perceptions and the expectations of the Obama voters, the change message and all the rest of it. But, you know, what we've seen is so much disenchantment, so much hostility and frustration. And a lot of people are going to be sitting on their, sitting at home and not voting, including core constituencies in Black America and among minorities, largely because of the inattention of people in the White House and their deliberate strategy and elite top-down view of things. And we see it so clearly in this economic crisis where the Obama administration basically last week came out against a moratorium on foreclosures in the name of economic, the economy, keeping the economy going, while the banks themselves, even though they're against political limits on foreclosures, have themselves put a moratorium on foreclosures. I mean, it's bizarro.
Well, I think
Erica, to get back, why would the White House not want to fund those groups?
You know, here's the thing. I don't know the answer. My guess is that it's a combination of two things. One is they probably did not fully understand the effect that those groups had and could have, and so they just simply didn't give them credit. I mean, I know if you asked Rahm Emanuel, what did CRU and Melanie Sloan have to do with your victory in 2006, I guarantee that he would say nothing. So,
Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, too.
Pardon me?
But
Howard Dean's 50-state strategy as well.
I mean, that's another thing. You know, Rahm and Howard Dean, like, routinely, you know, very well-publicized fights about where to spend the money. People like to think that they're responsible for things that go well, and they don't want to think they're responsible for things that go badly. So I think that that's one thing, that they actually don't understand the value of an infrastructure, how it works. They're really political players rather than movement players, and that's fine. You know, you can be a political player. We need all people on the team, but I do think that there's got to be a healthy respect. But here's the thing. Progressives need to have a healthy respect for the fact that at a certain point somebody has to vote for something. And so progressive donors who, you know, spend millions of dollars on environmental causes but don't want to fund elections are making a really stupid decision and not executing a very good strategy in trying to promote their efforts, and by the same token, politicians and political operatives who don't understand the value of and need for this external infrastructure are also making a bad calculus. So we have two people in, you know, in both parts of this making bad decisions. That's number one. Number two, I also think, particularly in a presidential race and one with, you know, as heightened, you know, sensibilities as this one had, with Barack Obama being the first African American president, and you know, this great, you know, the Sarah Palin factor and blah 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 blah. I think that they really wanted control over what happened, and you do when you grow things outside of what your individual focus is, you do give up control. So
that's it. Sherry, one second. Sherry, I have to cut in here. Excuse me, because we have to do a break. Erica, could you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Sure.
We have to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're here every week at this time. We'd love to have your input and support. The program will be available on a podcast for you to listen to and share with your friends. So stay with us here on PRN News Dissector Radio.
Some love the neighbors, some want to build the things. Half a life is pure, the rest is skin and bone. They all come together in this place.
To the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hi, I'm Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
Well, that was the anthem of my film, In Debt We Trust. It came out in 2006, warning of the financial crisis. We'll hear a little bit from the soundtrack of my movie, Plunder, at the end of the program. Erica Payne has stayed with us. She's with the Agenda Project. Tell me a little bit more about what your project is actually doing. How do you interact and work with various people in the party and in politics and in the public?
Oh, sure. So beginning in very late 2002, I embarked on a project with Rob Stein and Simon Rosenberg to look at why the progressive movement was all screwed up. And it was a big project. We're not done yet. But we basically looked at this idea that the conservatives, beginning in 1964 after the Goldwater election, had built this set of institutions, think tanks, legal advocacy groups, all of this stuff, that ultimately had turned the whole fabric of the policy climate of the country to the right. And that they, you know, in so doing, Republicans and then increasingly conservative Republicans had taken over control of the government, and that even Democrats who were in charge were more conservative. So we started looking at all of that. And so Rob has this famous PowerPoint presentation that details all of it that you can probably find online somewhere, but it's definitely something every progressive, I think, should see. And we embarked on this project to show people what the problem was, and that took a couple of years, and then formed this organization called the Democracy Alliance. And Rob and I had some different views about how the strategy that the organization should go through to build this infrastructure. And so he stayed with the organization, and I started working on the same kind of problem in a slightly different way. And so what I started doing was working with one or two organizations at a time that I thought were key parts of this infrastructure, and working with them either through a major startup phase or through a big transition. And alongside of that, in addition to building these individual pieces, which I did through my consulting practice, Tesseract, I also wanted to tell people this bigger story about all of these things that needed to happen in concert with one another. And so, among other things, I wrote the book, The Practical Progressive, How to Build a 21st Century Political Movement, which is really just kind of a reference book. I mean, you shouldn't say this about your own book, but it's not particularly interesting. You know, and you're not going to sit down and read it at the beach, you know, but in terms of having a reference on your desk when you're looking at how to engage in politics, it profiles 80 of the leading progressive organizations in the country. Interestingly enough, 40 of them were built kind of in the last 5 or 6 years. So there was this big, this big surge of entrepreneurial energy. So in addition to doing the book and doing a newsletter which tracks the development and efforts of those organizations, I started an informal breakfast series in New York with two big liberal philanthropists here, Maureen White and Gail Furman. And our goal was, we kind of thought, you know, every time anybody expresses an interest in politics, the first thing somebody says to them is, great, give me $2,000 and come hear the senator say something not very interesting for 30 minutes, you know, and then you won't hear from them again until the next year when the senator needs more money. And if you really want to build something interesting, that's not a very good way to go about it.
Let me just tell our listeners that there is a website that's quite good, agendaproject.org, where you can read more about Erica and her work. And I was at, as I said, this discussion about Obama. Hopefully, we'd love to play some of it on this program, because I thought the discussion was really first rate and quite analytical. Jonathan Alter, by the way, is in my film, People's President, that I made about the Obama campaign, and he's an old friend of mine. So I feel like these issues really need to be explored more. I just feel like there is not just one kind of politics. It's not just electoral politics. There has been movement politics. Yes, it's true. The Republicans formed these institutions, but in that era, we had the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and far more powerful popular forces. And the problem is that the political system is out of sync often with the aspirations and the energy of people at the base. We see that very clearly with this financial crisis, where people are asking across this country, why aren't we prosecuting, why aren't we jailing some of these corporate criminals? There was a sludge incident in Hungary. The corporation that did it, the owner was arrested immediately. I mean, in other words, there's no perception of any justice here and fairness in our economy.
our politicians are not speaking to it. They don't even seem to understand it. They're caught up in the minutiae, I believe, of policy and politics and not dealing with these deeper issues. But on the other hand, we can't simply create our own world of debate. We have to deal with the real world, and I think Erica is trying to, at least maybe the surreal world, is trying to do that with the Agenda Project. And I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
And I hope that we can continue some sort of relationship. You need a megaphone, a bigger megaphone for what you're doing. I'm not claiming that this program represents it, but I do think that you need to begin to engage with the so-called base and with people who care about politics to debate these issues, to learn from you, and perhaps for you to learn from them. So
that sounds great. Danny, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Sherry,
thank you. Erica. You are the real Mama Grizzly.
Oh, you're sweet.
Television.
Thank you so much.
Special thanks to Sherry for arranging this interview with Erica Payne. Erica is one of the young kind of intellectual activists who is very practically oriented, who's a real down-in-the-trenches person. And I think she has a lot to offer, and that we need to pay attention not just to what the politicians are saying, but to the people who are engaged in this debate to try to make some sort of politics in this country makes sense in terms of the issues that matter and the like. I mean, so I'm sort of frustrated about all of this because I still think that the discourse is much too inside baseball, not really dealing with the popular attitudes in the country, and that all this money that's being raised is not really speaking to what the needs are of the American people in this incredible financial crisis that we're part of. Aaron Crown is going to be joining us in a few minutes from the ML Implode website. We're going to be talking about really the biggest crisis going on right now, what's been called the fraud closure crisis. Eddie Morales coined that phrase. He works with people to try to stop foreclosures, fraud closure. And, we have a massive situation. 250,000 foreclosure sales are about to be reversed, pretty much. And that means halting evictions. And people are basically not going to be able to get these bargains of buying up people's property and buying up their lives for a song because of all the fraud that's been committed here. So this is something that we need to investigate, we need to get into. I've been following it. I've been talking about this every week. That's why I played the song There's No Place Like Home, because that is the central, one of the oldest songs in America, and how people's aspirations for a home have been perverted, turned into a business, turned into a fraudulent scam, which has led the FBI to say that we have pervasive mortgage fraud in our country. And still to this day, we are talking about a foreclosure fraud, but we're not yet talking about the fraud of the whole process. And that's why I invited Aaron Crown back on the show. Aaron edits the ML-Implode website. They're the people that created the Implodometer to basically track the implosions of mortgage lenders, hedge funds, home builders, and banks. He does a news service every day with a wide range of articles from the libertarian right to occasionally the more correct left. Aaron, thank you for joining me again.
Hi, Danny.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Let's go through some of the stories that you've been following on this foreclosure issue. What is the state of play on this right now? I mean, we have the administration opposed to a moratorium, and yet the banks are instituting moratoriums.
Right. Yeah, the administration is acting as kind of a water carrier for the banks, as they have most of the time. But what it is essentially a fundamental legal issue about securitized mortgages that is blowing up in the face of banks. And what they're doing is an extensive damage control and trying to spin this as just a procedural issue, with how the transactions are done, just saying that their T's weren't crossed and their I's weren't dotted. It's actually much more fundamental than that.
I mean, one robo-signer, this guy Jeffrey Steven, signed off on as many as 10,000 foreclosures a month, according to court
right.
records. He signed these documents. Did he have time to really read any of them?
Right, and of course, that's fraud. Of course, he didn't have time to read them. So, you know, his affidavit that essentially states that he did read them is false, and that is a crime. But I think it's important for listeners to understand that the reason banks were doing that, committing that sort of fraud, doing this robo-signing, is because they have no legal basis to foreclose on these loans. The ownership is clouded. The trusts were never what they call perfected. And as I wrote about 3 years ago on the site I used to own, I Am Facing Foreclosure, the true sale question of whether these loans were truly sold and done properly into the trust was never settled.
Let's explain this a little bit. I know it's complicated. I know that a lot of people's eyes glaze over when they hear all of this. But it starts with me. Let's say I'm buying a home, okay? And I have a mortgage, broker who's basically wants to sell me this home. And he's basically telling me, you know, that he can give me a good deal on a mortgage. Then what happens? Next step.
Right, so you take out this loan and it's funded by a bank somewhere, even if you went to a broker. And, you know, you can go into a lender's, what they call warehouse funding line, but after a short amount of time, the loan is what they call seasoned. You know, it lasts for at least a couple months of regular payments, and then it gets sold into a trust by the bank.
A trust being a package of more mortgages, right?
I mean, right. Now, this is a standalone vehicle that the banks created as a container for the loans, most loans in the country that were originated. So what this let them do is move to more of a architecture where it was what they call a transactional system, where they're focusing on originating and selling the loans and then booking a profit rather than holding it over a long period of time and, you know, kind of cultivating the loan and keeping it on their books.
Right. So a lot of people don't know this, that the loan that you take out very quickly can be resold into this
right.
entity, this trust that's sort of a mystery vehicle in
right.
some way, and then packaged with other loans, which are then resold to investors in other countries who are buying. Like, you know, I would like to take out part of loan A here in tier two of this tranche, you know.
Right.
So therefore, I want to invest in Aaron's bathroom on the second floor, you know. That's what I own, okay?
It was that sort of thing, absolutely. And of course, as we found with some of these other scandals and Goldman Sachs, the SEC, they originated a lot of these second tier structures specifically to bet against them. But that's a whole nother.
All right, let's get to that a little bit later.
But
in other words,
so
the guy gives me the loan, but he checks me out. And he says to me, Danny, you know, I know your credit score is not as good as it maybe should be. And, you know, I'd like you to be in this home. I think it would be great for you. You know, there's equity in it. You'll be able to take the equity out. You'll be able to resell it. You can't lose. Real estate always goes up, Danny. It's
right.
a great deal. But, you know, because you don't meet our criteria, we have to make this a sort of subprime loan, which means your fees are going to be a little bit higher, okay?
Right.
And there's an adjustable rate here, but don't worry about it because, as we've said before, it's not going to get too high. Isn't this what they were telling people?
Yeah, and yes, definitely. But it didn't even have to be a subprime loan. I want to stress that most mortgages went into these trust vehicles, these standalone trusts, and so that's where the real question is, because this was not a traditional structure that was used to originate home loans. Those are, you know, they're standard 30-year fixed loans. The bank held them and kept them. Maybe it went to Fannie or Freddie, but that was pretty much it. But aggressively, what they started doing in 2003, 2004 was to send the mortgages straight to these trusts and collect a fee off of doing that. And every time they bounced them around and slice and dice them, collect more fees. So it looked better for the bottom line.
See,
but at the end of the day, here's the irony. The banks, by and large, still hold all these mortgages. They just hold them through these trusts, these third-party entities. And that's the problem, because they've clouded the authority to foreclose. They've clouded even the notion of who really owns the note. And this is called the true sale issue. And as they raise in court, what's called the real party in interest. So who is the real party that has authority to foreclose? And the banks have created many layers of indirection, which help them, you know, there's more.
No, they camouflage. It's all camouflaged, right, in these structures. What people really don't understand is this is kind of a, they have financial architects, like an architect of a building, designing these structures, structured finance. This is a sort of a, poses as a science. And there were these experts, you know, quants or I don't know what they were, who were analyzing all of this and creating this whole structure. And you, 3 years ago, reported on a case, I believe, in Ohio, where the judge said, okay, you know, with the people being thrown out of their homes said, wait a minute, do you have the mortgage? And they couldn't produce it.
Right. It was the lawyers for these people demanded that the banks produce a note. It was Deutsche Bank, I believe, in that case. And Judge Boyko saw that the bank could not produce a note and threw out the case. And the bank had to go back and refile and try to do things the right way. But we reported on that and then interviewed April Charney, who's one of the top foreclosure legal aid attorneys in the country, one of the top experts in this area. And she enlightened us on the real party in issue question and the true sale question. And the point I took away from that, and we went back and looked at some bankruptcy industry publications from 2003, there's an article by a guy named Tim Reason, which is a great name. But he basically said, in analyzing the situation after Enron, that the legal status of these trusts had never been settled. They basically glossed over it after Enron and some of the other dot-coms collapsed. And these are the kind of vehicles they used for their accounting fraud. So what they did is they took a vehicle being used for accounting fraud that was a key element of the dot-com collapse, and they made it the backbone of the residential mortgage industry.
So, I mean,
Without settling any of these legal questions.
So the legal questions are unsettled. People think they're in a home. They think it's theirs. The mortgage has been sold to somebody else. And, you know, and you get sick and you can't make a payment. And somehow, and even in one case in Florida, guy didn't even have a mortgage. His home was foreclosed upon. I mean, you know, it's a situation of so much absurdity. Then they set up this thing called MERS. What's that?
Yeah, MERS is basically the administrator that holds the mortgages in an electronic database. And they essentially thought they were going to get away with doing the county recording that you have to do locally for the mortgage in virtually every jurisdiction in the country and just do it all in their database. And actually, Fannie and Freddie at one point got behind this and mandated it. So the federal government was behind it as well. But again, no one really check to see if the legal authorization was behind this, and especially when MERS is the agent on the foreclosure and claiming that they are the real party in interest and that they are authorized and that they can be
and
the plaintiff.
And this was a completely wholly owned sort of set up by the banks, making fees on these things. Nobody checks the legality of anything.
They have these robo machines.
I mean,
right.
Robo-signers. You know, the process is faulty, mistakes, it's all riddled with error, riddled with fraud. People are losing their homes. People are breaking into their homes, changing the locks, claiming that they are the real owners of the property when the ownership is really in dispute or doesn't exist at all. I mean, this is...
I want to add something else real
this
quick.
This is theft! Aaron, theft!
Yeah. Bank analyst Christopher Whalen wrote a few weeks ago that he was at the Fed in the early 90s and late 80s, and he wrote that it would only cost them about 0.5% on their total profits to put these vehicles together and do it legally correctly. But for that, to capture that 0.5% profit, they just ignored all the legal requirements for what they have to do to transfer these loans.
Well, let's just kind of hit the main point of the implications of all of this, because this is a massive shock to the economy. You wouldn't have all these big banks, GMAC, Bank of America, now Wells Fargo's in the mess too, J.P. Morgan Chase, all of them announcing foreclosures, stopping evictions, if they weren't really worried that they have been caught, you know, in an incredible scam.
Right. And I think there
wasn't Congressman Kaptur out of Ohio one of the first people to tell the homeowners, don't leave your house until they can prove who owns it?
Right. She got onto this about a year before everyone else did. It was after we started writing about it, and it was in the blogosphere for a while. And those who knew that this was an issue, but we didn't know whether it would really blow up.
Well, it's blown up.
Apparently it has.
Aaron,
oh, yeah.
It is blown up. I mean, this is something that, you know, seemed to be so obscure, you know, just the details. You know, this is not about anything important. It's just some paperwork problems. But, in fact, behind all of this is a massive scandal, foreclosure or fraud closure gate. And this has not gone away. This is something that has yet to be resolved. The administration seems to be ducking and covering. And not taking a high-profile role in all of this to try to, you know, intervene on behalf of the homeowners who are being victimized here. And you know, we have a situation where people think that this will go away if they don't talk about it. But it's
well, didn't Secretary Geithner just say that it would be have massive implications if foreclosures weren't allowed to go forward?
Absolutely. And there's an interesting aspect of this, which is that maybe the best thing the administration can do is do nothing and let the lawyers around the country tear MERS apart and tear apart these trusts and get some relief that way.
See, I mean, MERS is done as far as I can see. I mean,
MERS is done. Well, the banks are abandoning MERS, you know, as by the hour. They're taking MERS off of their lawsuits and trying to put them back together and proceeding on their own behalf, which still doesn't answer the legal questions.
I mean, here's a story that you put out this morning, which is courtesy of Alan Grayson's office in Florida. We discover that not only are the servicers of these mortgages foreclosing on mortgages, but no one, in which nobody owns the title, but that the servicers representing so-called reputable firms like Deutsche Bank, National Trust, etc., are counterfeiting court summonses in their pursuit of a clean and efficient foreclosure mill. So
right. You
can be foreclosed on without knowing there was even a foreclosure case against you. I mean, this is in ML dash implode today, and then their email newsletter. I really urge you to get it. I would just say
there's a lot of aspects of the process like that. They've had to forge it because they really have no legal authority to do this, especially not with the speed that they're trying to do
it. Well, you know, Aaron, thanks again for coming on to clarify all of this. You're the expert, you know, as far as I'm concerned. I was really happy to meet you finally in Washington, D.C. We had a lovely dinner in the basement of the Union Station. I'm really hoping that this issue will get legs, as they say, and be kind of mushroom into the level of a national scandal. Unfortunately, you know, everybody's sort of politicians are hiding. The president seems to be hiding, but the public is outraged. And I think we're going to see a lot more on this issue. And you heard about it here, in detail, because it's important to understand the details. So, by the way, I want to say to everyone, thank you again for your letters and your comments. Plunder the Crime of Our Time is my website, plundercrimeofourtime.com, about the movie, which really looks at these criminal practices in some detail, although, you know, the details are coming fast and furiously almost every day now. There are reports that despite the foreclosure moratoriums, the banks are still foreclosing on people. So the truth is hard to get at here unless we pay attention and monitor it closely. That's what what I do in my blog on mediachannel.org, newsdissector.com/blog. That's what we try to do here on News Dissector Radio. The podcast of this show will be available, and I will be posting and tweeting it. You can follow me on Twitter. Follow me and follow Sherry on Facebook. We're trying to make ourselves accessible. We're trying to engage you in this issue. We think it's very important, and clearly it is very important. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back again Friday at 1 next week. Thank you for joining us here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Here's the theme song for Plunder.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers, laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.